listener to give us those necessary words of encouragement and through exhortation. We'll call upon our brother Malcolm.
The first Old Testament portion is from the book of Joshua. And the section that we read from Joshua is one that has attracted the attention of many Sunday school teachers over the years, and attracted the attention of people who write music. And in the early days, a lot of our Bible stories came to us because they were put into song form or such, so that people who really couldn't read would understand and get to know what these stories were about. And for Negro slaves in the South, many of the Bible stories were carried in song form. And so we have this song that Joshua fit the Battle of Jericho, and the walls came tumbling down, and that descending scale enforces and emulates the idea of the walls falling. So the music not only carried the words, but it carried the ideas as well. And so this morning, well, I want to start out by looking at some of these ideas and seeing that even though these ideas really are quite fun little stories, they carry very serious and very lasting examples, and yet very simple examples for each of us even today. Now, at this point where we are in the book of Joshua, in the middle of the book of Joshua, the nation is about to cross Jordan. They're sort of standing on the one side and wondering what's in front of them. And the wonderment was there because sometime earlier, 12 men had gone into this country that they were about to enter to find out what was in front of them. Now, most of those spies, as they're called in the translation that I by favor, most of those spies had come back and said, it's not going to be an easy job for us to actually inhabit that country, because there are cities there, they have big walls, they can defend themselves, they're strong people, there are societies that are cohesive. It's going to be very hard for us to break in, and particularly hard for us to overtake the cities that are there. Two of the spies came back, and they didn't disagree. They didn't disagree with anything that had been said by the others. Yes, it wasn't going to be easy, but they did bring back two things. They said that this is a very fertile land. It's a land that's well worth going into. And they proved it with an enormous bunch of grapes, probably ripped up a whole vine, grapes and root and everything, and brought it back that way. And they also said, we've got nothing to worry about. Yes, it's tough. Yes, this nation, this ragtag little army, had very little military experience at that point in time. Some, but not a lot. The place where they were particularly weak and inexperienced was in siege warfare. And what the one group of spies had said was that there are strong cities with big walls, well defended. We're going to have a lot of trouble. We're not going to be able to make it, said 10 of them. And the two said, don't worry about it. Now, into all of this comes today's debate. There's, of course, the Da Vinci Code, which is going on, which is questioning and raising stories, which are by no means new. These things have been around for a long time, this idea of whether Jesus really did have any offspring or not, and so on. It's been kicking around in Christian circles for ages. It's interesting that all of a sudden it's caught people's imaginations. So all of these things are there. The other great debate which is going on in Bible circles surrounds archaeology. Whether or not we can reliably date and rely on the stories which come to us from a time earlier than the time of the kings. And certainly in 150 years ago, nearly now, when Garstang dug up the walls of Jericho and he found that walls had indeed fallen, he radioed right back to Britain, sent a message right back to Britain that he'd found the walls of Jericho. The walls had fallen down, and the story of Joshua then was vindicated. Well, nowadays the archaeologists have trouble equating the time, the wall certainly that Garstang found, and the interval that it is felt that the Israelites came out of Egypt. But the interesting thing is that the walls of Jericho fell down more than once. At least twice, probably three times. They were unstable. The town had been rebuilt on a number of occasions. And we also know that it's in an earthquake plain, so there's probably very good reason for the walls of Jericho to fall down. So what comes out of all of this when you look at the debate and you think of this as a spiritual story first and foremost? History, yes. The Jewish history, and when we were in Israel, we met several Jews who didn't look on the Bible as being divine at all, but certainly looked on it as being a history book. These two things come together, and they come together for us in the example of Joshua. Because the thing which was brought out in the first place and in the strongest place with this story was, yes, they would have trouble overtaking these cities. They would need assistance to do it. But what they had to do was place their faith in the Lord, because they had been brought through a number of tribulations, a number of trials, a number of difficulties already. They had survived in inhospitable terrain a large number of people for longer than anyone could imagine already. And yet they had difficulty seeing that God had been part of their lives, had taken care of them to this point. And surely then, God wasn't going to dump them, as we say nowadays, dump them when they looked at what was for them a promised land. And so they got this procession together and they marched around Jerusalem. Prior to that, they'd come across the River Jordan and come across some dry land. And of course, we know nowadays that there are occasions when the banks of Jordan collapse. The water's dammed up periodically, and this timing of one of those collapses was no doubt what allowed the Israelites to come across Jordan on dry land. Two things are there, though. One was the fact, the coincidence of them coming across and in dry conditions when nobody else imagined that they could do it. And secondly, that they were able to find stones. And they built with those stones a monument. For you see, this concept of a monument is starting to be important. And in a few minutes, we're going to look at a couple of problems in the text. Two things that make the textual scholars fret about the text of the Bible and wonder whether it's real and should be relied on. But the thing we need to grasp when we look at those problems is the idea given to us, one, that these people should put their faith in God and God would care for them no matter what obstacles were put in their way through life. And secondly, that there should be monuments, things that reminded them of what had gone on in their lives, things that reminded them that God had been part of their lives in the past, had cared for them, had looked after them, and had enabled them to overcome enormous obstacles, obstacles which none of them imagined they were capable of doing on their own. And so they walked around the city of Jericho. On the seventh day after they'd gone around, the walls fell, as we know. But now we come to another thing, and couple of digressions. I'm going to digress a little bit once or twice here. 17th chapter, verse of the 6th chapter of Joshua, and the city shall be accursed. The city shall be accursed, even it and all that are therein to the Lord. Now, that's interesting. What's it mean to be accursed? And we find in the next chapter that there was somebody who actually availed himself of this accursed thing, as it is in my translation. Now, I want to, at this point, just back up and, as I said, digress completely, because what I want to do is recommend to you that you make time in the beginning of July to go to the Bible exhibition that some of us are putting together in Sydney. Because, and it's this word accursed which triggers that little idea. Because in the middle of the 19th century, there came to be a lot of new discoveries made. The Codex Sinaiticus was discovered in the early part of the 19th century. And there are a couple of other very old and very important documents also found in that same period. And when all of these new documents were put together, people realized that the text of the Bible actually went back a lot further than they had previously imagined. Went back at least to the 4th century, in essentially the same form that we have it in the Masoretic text, which has given us this text that we use in our Bibles today. And then came the question was, well, all these texts are a little bit different. Just how important are the differences? It just so happens that in the collection of books that we've been making in this meeting for a long time and have been the basis of the Bible exhibition that was used at the P&E for a number of years, that there are a number of New Testament texts and interesting texts which point out some of these differences and some of how important and how much we have to worry about these differences in texts. And they gave rise to the Revised Version, which was produced, the New Testament in 1881 and the Old Testament in 1885. In our collection, we have two first editions of the Revised Version. So we have some interesting books there. But we also have this whole question of the matter of what differences in texts and what it meant and how reliable they were. And whether the words which were here in Shakespearean English, this word accursed, really was that good and what it meant. And in my Bible, in the margin, there's the word devoted there instead of accursed. And that was the word that came to be used when the revisers prepared their version of 1885. Just a little difference in emphasis. Because what we're coming to is the idea that the city of Jericho and everything in it was to be considered God's. People were not to help themselves to the loot that was put in front of them by the good fortune of their overtaking Jericho. People were to realize that the gold and silver that was there should be used in the temple dedicated to God, not taken for personal gain, and that the rest of it was to be left alone. Why should this be so? Because of the lesson that they should already have learned, that faith in God would carry the day for them. They didn't need that money. They were going to start a new life in a new land, a land which was fertile enough to take care of all of their needs. They were going to build new houses, get new things, put new lives together. They didn't need to pick up money on the way. God would see to it that their industry, their work, and we're going to come to that word when we get to the New Testament, that their work would be rewarded. It was faith that should carry the day. And the realization that we shouldn't pick up and help ourselves to all the things that are put in our way because God would take care of our needs. And secondly, that we had to realize that some things belong to God, should be reserved for God, and should be left not for our own personal use. That message was brought home very, very forcefully in the example of this individual called Achan in the first verse of the 7th chapter. And Achan. And we realize that Achan, we're told as we turn over the page in the 7th chapter, that Achan took of the accursed thing, the thing that should have been devoted to God. It was a curse as far as he was concerned, because he should not touch anything that belonged to God. But it was something that didn't belong to him. And now we meet the first of the two little problems that we're going to look at in this text in Joshua. The Babylonish garment, which was there in the 21st verse. And the other little problem that we're going to look at is the last half a dozen words in this seventh chapter, the Valley of Achor, as it's called, as it's known, to this day, unto this day. What did it mean by that? What did it mean that somebody said it's still called the Valley of Achor? Well, if you're in 17th century England, I mean, you could accept that phrase very easily, because one would assume that these biblical places, their names had been intact through time, and one could accept that it was still, if you went to Israel, somebody would be there and they'd say, hey, you know, there's the valley. There's the valley. It's still called the same thing. But in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, people began to travel. They began to travel through this area. And they couldn't find these places. And so they began to think, well, you know, that phrase doesn't make sense. It must have been added later. You see, it makes no sense to have the phrase there. The Valley of Achor, unto this day, it's called the same thing. Unto which day? When was it written? Does that mean that sometime, somewhere, somebody made up the story and added that little idea to a place which had that name and said, here's a good story for you, guys. Here's a good spiritual lesson, as we say nowadays. Here's something which you should pay attention to. What was the reason that it was there? Now, the other point which we said is this concept of the Babylonish garment. And the archaeologists leap on these points because, of course, Babylon didn't exist at the time when Joshua was there. Oh, the land was there. The territory was there. But it wasn't called Babylon until much later. So if you go, that's the reason that you can go to a map nowadays. You don't find the word Babylon on a map unless it's an Old Testament map. But we still know where Babylon is. It's now called Iraq. And we know that there are all kinds of problems attached to that part of the world now. And here comes the point. Here comes the point for people nowadays, just as much as it was for people in Joshua's day, and just as much as it was for the time when somebody went through the text, and a lot of people think that it was probably Ezra, who went through the text and added many of these little phrases, these unto this day phrases. Because at the time of Ezra, you see, this people were beginning to remember when they came back from Babylon under Ezra, that that wasn't the first time that nation had made that journey. It wasn't the first time that that nation had been given the freedom of a new land and the promise of an existence in a new land. And when they did that, coming out of Egypt, this was not the first time that they had done that, that they had moved into God's land, God's promised land, and the promise. And when they built the monument there of those 12 stones, it was to remind them that they had made that journey. And the phrase at the end of that seventh chapter reminds them that they had made that journey again. They had to remember. You see, the Israelites were told to read their Bibles together as a family. And the question comes to us in the law, well, the children are going to sort of say, well, what's all this about? What does it mean? And they had to have ready answers. They had to be able to say that God has cared for us and that this piece of scripture, the one I'm thinking of right now was Passover, of course, that was for a reason. It was part of the development of our country. It was part of the development of our society. It was proof that God is with us. So when they came with Joshua into this new land and they met that enormous fortified city of Jericho, which they had no ability at all to destroy on their own, God did it for them. They had to realize one, faith, and two, that they didn't need to help themselves. God would look after them. So all these little phrases, and they were probably changed at some time when the text of the Bible went on, probably changed so that people really would realize that Babylon was the place that Abram had come from, even though it wasn't called Babylon when he came from it. Babylon, in figurative language, was where they had just come from, even though it was Egypt that they had moved from. It was Babylon that they came from when Ezra and Nehemiah. And nowadays, they have to be very conscious of the threat that's looking at Israel from the ancient land of Babylon. They have to be very conscious of the fact that God brought them out. Faith had picked them up in years gone by. But nowadays, the question really stands, doesn't it? When the Son of Man shall come, shall he find faith? Shall he find faith? So, yes, there are little words and phrases throughout the Bible that make you realize that indeed somebody else has touched the text as time goes on. But if you think about the changes that are made, they're there to reinforce the message of the text. And the message here is faith. The message here is that God is with us. The message here is that God will help us to overcome whatever obstacles there may be in our lives. And the message here is that we do not need to help ourselves as Achan did to gold and silver. God will provide for our needs. And the other message that we really should remember is that God's people have come out of inhospitable areas. They've been protected when they came out of those inhospitable areas. They've been cared for when they came out of what was figuratively at this time Babylon. And that people who looked back at those Babylonish garments and thought, isn't it neat? Wouldn't I love to have some of that? Didn't benefit from their longings. Chapter in Isaiah, of course, has an interesting little idea that God will pick up the outcasts of his nation. And it's there for us, this idea that we've been talking about from the Old Testament is there in a future sense in that 11th chapter of Isaiah to remind us that the promises that were made in the time of Joshua are still there. God is still conscious of the needs of his people, and that God is still there to protect his people. Now, I want to move into into Thessalonians in the New Testament for a few minutes. It's interesting when you sort of get to be an old guy like me, it's interesting that you sort of look back on time, and one of the things that you look back on are some of the fire and thunder sort of exhortations that we used to get in years gone by, and some of the other platform expressions and so on that you used to hear quite regularly. And one of them was this idea of things, you know, there being no accidents in Scripture. This idea came up by a lot of people. He said, it doesn't matter where you go, the Old Testament, the New Testament, you got the same points. They're reinforced. Well, I want to sort of reinforce another point for you here. With the fire and thunder way that was done 50 years ago, but nonetheless, to sort of think back and realize that points that were made by the old-timers were really very valid. That you do meet the same idea when you move from the Old Testament into the New Testament. It comes to you in a slightly different form, but nonetheless, it's the same idea. Now, the point that we had was that we should put faith in God. The other point which we had was that we should not avail ourselves of treasures. There are things you should not do. And that was the example of Achan, who stole treasure that should have been given, left for God. There are things which you should not do. Two points which really should come to us from Joshua. One, that faith conquers all. Shall we say that? And the second one is that we should be careful of what we do in life, there are things that we should not do. And Achan stealing that garment and stealing that money was an example of something which we should not do. When we come to the New Testament, now the other point just before we go into the New Testament was that Achan was dealt with in a very severe manner. And the Old Testament has been criticized many times for this blood and thunder approach. People are killed, they just got rid of that way. If you're not supposed to mix with them, you get rid of them. Well, the New Testament takes the same concept, but approaches it in a little different form. There are things which we should not do, and there are steps which we should take to make sure that we don't do them. We're not going to kill Achan in our day and age, but we still don't want to have anything to do with someone who lines their own pockets and who forgets that there should be time for God in their lives. Now we command you, brethren, finally, brethren, the first verse of this third chapter of Thessalonians, 2 Thessalonians, finally, brethren, pray for us that the word of the Lord may have free course and be glorified, even as it is with you. For the Lord is faithful, and we have confidence in the Lord, touching you, as you both do. So, you see, the concept that we're building on is very much the same as the concept that Joshua was building in that nation when they crossed Jordan and started a new life. Joshua had confidence in his people, and he said, you should have confidence in the presence of God in your lives. And that's the sort of thing that Paul is saying to us here. But when we get to the sixth verse, we say, now we command you, brethren, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that ye withdraw yourselves from every brother that walketh disorderly, that ye withdraw yourselves from people, from brethren, from whomever, who walk in a disorderly fashion. Now, that word withdraw is an interesting little word. It's used twice by Paul in the New Testament. It's one of the ways that this root word was used was when you furl a sail. So you take this big sail, which traps a lot of wind, and you draw it together and wrap it up and tie it up so that it's a lot smaller. And that's the root meaning of this word, to withdraw yourself, to make it smaller. And so you see the image of there being a big sail which can trap all kinds of stuff is changed to being something smaller which will avoid much of the wind and much of the problems that can be blown your way with the wind. So the idea is that you become small enough to avoid, to get away from the problems that are around you. Now, Paul uses this in one other place, and that's in 2 Corinthians, the 8th chapter. And in that chapter, Paul is discussing an incident that he, and he doesn't mention the individual who was traveling with him, but from the Acts we can surmise who it was, that they were moving among the churches, they were journeying together. And one of the things which, and again, this isn't laid out specifically, but it's with the choice of words, it's almost certainly, is that they were carrying money. They were carrying money as relief money to some of the New Testament churches around Asia Minor. We know from Acts that this was done on more than one occasion, that the brethren did help financially meetings that were in trouble, that needed financial help. And in the 8th chapter of Corinthians, of 2 Corinthians then, Paul is pointing out that what he is determined to do, him and his companion, was to act in such a way that they would not be accused of profiting personally from whatever else went along with their journey. They did carry money, they did carry letters, they carried a number of things to the new churches. Paul did not want to be accused of profiting personally from that situation. You see, it's the reverse of the situation that Achan got into when Jericho was destroyed. There were things in Jericho that were God's, and Achan said, no, I would rather have it for myself. Paul was saying that he was acting to avoid, it's 20th verse of the 8th chapter if you're looking at up. Paul was saying that he was acting in such a way that he would avoid being accused. He was making himself small. He was not standing up and proclaiming his own wonderful way of going about, his leading role in the church. Paul was not doing that. And Paul was making every effort to make sure that people realized that he was acting in an honorable fashion, that he would not profit personally from his position. Now this, in spite of the fact that in another place, Paul had said the workman is worthy of his hire. And Paul made it quite clear that there was nothing wrong with him being fed and cared for by the brethren and sisters as he journeyed, because that was his work. That was his work. And we said to you, we're going to pick up this word work again later on. And it's here a little further down. And it comes to you courtesy of my maternal grandmother that I have described for you from this platform on a number of occasions. This is the grandmother that when I was a difficult little kid with hair on the top of my head, that she would take me by the hand and drag me along when we were going somewhere, and she'd say, now you're going to come and you're going to enjoy it. That's the grandmother. And this grandmother was a very dominant, very assertive single mother, one of the people that made her way in life because she had to. She was on her own, and she had to look after her children. And one of the other phrases that she hammered me with more than once was, those who don't work don't eat. And it's here for us in Thessalonians. You see, this phrase brings back everything that we have said. What Joshua was saying to his troops as they went into the new land was, come along and do God's work. You will be provided for. You don't need to pick somebody's pocket on the way. You certainly don't need to take things that are going to be dedicated to the Lord exclusively. Their work was laid out for them. It was an honorable work. They would be rewarded for it. Paul said the same thing. The workman is worthy of his hire, but I am not going to take things that don't belong to me. He made that quite clear. And in this use of that word withdraw, he's making it quite clear that it's important that we do not become self-effacing in the actions that we take as we go about this work. And those who don't work don't eat. Comes to us in two forms. For nowadays, we do things differently than the first century church did. The first century church would get together in the evenings and they would have a communal meal. They would eat it together, and it was brought in much the way we probably bring potlucks in today. And when they were all there, there would be bread as part of that meal, and it was always a fact that they remembered that broken life of Jesus in the bread that they picked up as part of that meal. They were more of a community than we are today. So it's easy for us to not notice when we look at a phrase like those who don't work, don't eat, to not notice that the primary meaning here was of, when Paul was saying, was the people acting as a community and coming together in the strength of that community, in the strength of the work that they had done on behalf of Jesus, and realizing that when they shared the communal bounty of food that they had, that they remembered that this was there by the bounty of God. It was their faith which should have brought them together, as faith took them across the River Jordan years gone by. It was their faith which should sustain them and mean that they did not need to go out and do all sorts of unseemly things to pad their pockets, or whatever was meant with that idea of withdrawing from those individuals. And it did mean that they should remember the Lord as part of their lives, and that one of the eating things that they did was certainly when they took bread together and remembered their Lord Jesus.